I'm Dwayne Pendergast, your moderator for today's session. Remember, there's a basket on your table to collect your $10 payment for lunch and SACPA support. Have someone at the table check the total so it'll be ready for pickup. The only free lunch today is for our speaker. We thank the University of Lethbridge and the Lethbridge Herald for their continuing support. And for the sake of new participants, and there are some, I note we start with a 25 to 30 minute presentation. Then we have lunch and a 30 minute question period starting about 1 p.m. Our topic today is energy, environment, and the economy, discovering Alberta's future. Our speaker is Dr. David Lazell, Executive Director of University of Calgary's Institute for Sustainable Energy, Environment, and Economy. I first met David in the last century. We were both involved with Canada's planning for the Kyoto Protocol. As a plant scientist at Queen's University, he recognized the tremendous ability of Canada's croplands, prairies, and forests to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. He set up a research organization, the BioCap Foundation, to seek climate change solutions based on that. I recall he was involved with many Albertans from academia and industry over the years. We're very lucky he has moved to Alberta to continue with his work. Thanks, David, for coming all the way from Calgary to tell us about it. The podium is yours, and if you'd prefer the pacing space, that's yours too.
Great, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here, and what I would like to do is to, you know, begin by looking at the issues that we see in the newspaper every day. And I think anybody who's listened to the news on television, on the radio, or read a newspaper knows that we have an issue today of two issues that are coming together to create a sort of a perfect storm that is a major challenge for Canada, for Alberta, for Canada, for North America, and for the world. These are related to energy security and climate change. And the fact that these are coming together at a time of where there's serious financial collapse within our economy is a real challenge, but also creates an opportunity. And one thing that's very clear from this coming together, this perfect storm, is that the way we've been doing things, the status quo, or the business as usual, is not an option. There's going to need to be major change. And when we look at energy security, I think an important thing to note is that energy demand is going to continue to rise. Even though we're seeing perhaps a collapse in the economy right now, there may be a short decline, but it will be coming back. And one of the main reasons can be seen on this plot, which is a graph on the vertical axis here. We see energy use per capita, and down here is gross domestic product per capita. And you notice that we've got Europe is in the center here, Europe and Japan, Canada and the United States are way up here. We have very high energy use per capita given our GDP. And countries like South Korea have gone through a transition over the past 50 years and moved up along the scale. Along this relationship. There is a very strong relationship that as you increase your GDP and improve the economic and the quality of life for the citizens, there is an increase in energy use. The important point is what's happening in China and India. China and India in the last decade or so are starting to move up this curve and following the same path as South Korea. That's one-third of the world's population are moving to increase their GDP, their quality of life, and their economics development within those countries, and there's going to be a major increase in their energy use. Certainly in North America, we need to reduce our energy use, probably bring us more in line with Europe or Japan on a per capita basis, but even if we do that, and we must be doing that, I think there's going to be a global increase in energy demand. The International Energy Agency has in the past been very optimistic, and this is a major global organization looking at energy, and they've been very optimistic about our ability in the past to address the energy security, energy demands of the world. Until very recently, 6 months ago, for the first time, we started seeing reports in the newspaper suggesting that the energy watchdog warns of an oil production crisis or a crunch, and that our supplies may actual plateau below expected demand. There's a long-awaited report that's coming out next week, and I would actually suggest you look in the newspaper and watch, and it'll be coming out on the 12th, and I suspect we'll be seeing it in the popular press, called World Energy Outlook. And there's an expectation that that's going to be suggesting that we've got much more of a crunch in our ability of the world to supply future energy demands than what we've had in the past. This expectation of this report coming has led more and more discussion and lending support to a group of researchers around the world who've been talking about peak oil. Concerns about the conventional oil, which is the lower part of this graph here, the conventional oil production we know is peaking and it's going to be declining. There's been, in recent years, lots of unconventional oil being brought on, natural gas liquids, oil sands, deep drilling and deep water oil production systems that are hoping that's going to be making up some of the difference. But as we look at the next 40 years, the decline and the level of the gap is increasing dramatically. The expectation of when peak oil is going to occur, when the ability, it's not that we're running out of oil, there's lots of oil there, but when the ability to get that oil out of the ground at a fast enough rate to meet demands is thought to occur sometime within the next 0 to 8 years. It's not sure exactly when. The most optimistic talks at it about 20 years, and even that optimism may decline next week when we hear the International Energy Agency's report. There's an addition. There is a political unrest, a potential for political unrest in oil and gas producing countries, many of which have not been terribly friendly to North America, the United States in particular, may result in a disruption in world energy supplies. We've all experienced OPEC in the past and certainly concerns about supply that may mean that we'll have energy security issues even in the absence of peak oil. Now, one of the things that you might say on here is that, well, we've got oil sands, and we've got this unconventional oil that could really help to fill this gap. Here's what oil sands in Canada would do on a global basis. And oil sands, remember, are the second largest reservoir of oil, and bringing it onto production is a major challenge, as we all know. We're now at about 1.5 million barrels a day. That's at the peak, more or less where the line is, the vertical line, going to 2.7, perhaps by 2015, and up to 10 million barrels a day by 2050. We will need about 8 to 10 more oil sand developments around the world of that scale in order to fill the gap in the continuing demand with increased demand for oil. We know we're into a supply-demand challenge. So that is one piece on the energy security side, but the reality is as we move from conventional oil and gas to unconventional oil and gas, we find that there's a larger environmental footprint with the unconventional. There are more greenhouse gas emissions, and oil sands are no exception to that. And so they have higher emissions, and there's more of an environmental concern. So we turn to what our challenge is on the other side of this perfect storm, to what our challenges are in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Our emissions, since Dwayne and I were talking around Kyoto times, have gone up continuously. We made a commitment to reduce our emissions in the Kyoto period, the commitment period which started in January of this year, and instead we've never done too much. And indeed, business as usual emissions will take us from up to about 1.6 billion tons of CO2. This is in Canada alone, not the world, this is just Canada, by the mid-century. What we need to do if we want to address climate change is go through that reduction that looks something like the dotted line at the bottom. So we got this massive gap that is appearing. If where we need to be in 2050, if Canada is going to do its share of reducing emissions and holding the atmospheric CO2 concentration at about 2 times pre-industrial, which would be about a 2 degrees Celsius change, about twice the temperature change we've seen already, but that's thought to be within the realm of our about 2 to 3 times the change we've seen already. That's thought to be in the realm of safe strategy for climate change. we obviously need transformational change. We're going to need transformational change to address the energy security issue. We're also going to need transformational change to address the climate change issue. And as I pointed out before, some of the strategies we're using now for energy security are making the climate change issue more difficult to solve. So this is really the kind of platform and the background on which the Institute for Sustainable Energy, Environment, and Economy looks at and the challenges. And this is an institute that, at the University of Calgary, that really crosses six different faculties, from environmental design, that's a lot of architecture, that the business school, law, the engineering school, science, and the social science faculties. So it's an inter-faculty. If you're going to have solutions and develop solutions, they're rarely found within individual disciplines. And the focus of IC is to develop cost-effective solutions to address the environmental challenges of energy production and use. Our strategy is certainly multidisciplinary. You can tell by the partner faculties that we work with. Lots of stakeholder engagement, working with the energy sector and the cities, etc., that we're working that are going to be able to use those technologies and the insights that we generate. Multi-university partnerships, partnering, recognizing that University of Calgary, certainly as in, we would argue, the energy capital of Canada, is one of the places where we are strategically located, but there are lots of insights and values from universities across the country, across Alberta and across the country, that we want to tap into and cooperate with. Real focus on knowledge and technology transfer and on training highly qualified individuals that could help in this transition. We've identified four energy and environment strategies recently, and these are going to become the focus of what the University of Calgary is trying to do over the next few years in energy and environment space. The first one is addressing the problem we hear about all the time in Alberta, and a key issue. How do we reduce the emissions associated with hydrocarbon recovery and processing? There are lots of ways of doing it. You can reduce the emissions associated with the way we actually get it out of the ground. We're putting a huge amount of energy in now to do it. We're using very old technologies. We can change those. We know more. We can reduce those emissions. And we can reduce other aspects of the environmental footprint as well, like water use, etc. But then once you're still going to have emissions, and then we need to capture and store those emissions under the ground. And that's a carbon capture and storage. And that's the focus. Those two things are the focus of that priority. We also need to step back and say, well, where does this fit with a North American energy strategy for 2030? And I was very delighted, anybody read the Globe and Mail this morning, and actually some of the other newspapers, that the Prime Minister of Canada came out and said, we are going to couple the energy security issues with the climate change issues in our discussion, and a proposal went through to the new U.S. President-elect, Obama, that to develop a Canada-U.S. partnership on developing a North American energy strategy, especially around oil sands and climate change issues. I think it needs to even go further than that. It needs to look at renewable energy opportunities. It needs to look at bioenergy. It needs to look at energy conservation, the way we live, the way we design our cities, the way we move around. We need an integrated North American energy system and energy strategy. We need to look at the Arctic. The Arctic is the canary in the coal mine, if you like. It's the early warning. And certainly the change in climate change in the Arctic is huge. That's creating problems for the energy sector that already exists in the Arctic. And we need to understand how to reduce those problems and challenges. But it also is opened up opportunities for additional exploration. We have to address the question of should we be going up there for energy? And if we are, how do we make sure that it's not increasing our problem of climate change and our environmental footprint on the planet, but actually ideally reducing it. And finally, we need to look at our cities and our built spaces. How do we develop communities, whether it's smaller cities like Lethbridge or bigger cities like Calgary and others? How do we develop more sustainable communities that have a low carbon footprint in it? So these are the four areas that the University of Calgary is focusing on. There are other areas in energy and environment that one could think of, but these are areas that we think the university can make a significant contribution, and this will be the nature or the focus of our activities. So we come back to the climate change issue in Canada, and we ask the question, how do we fill this gap? Well, there's some work that we've done in the past with BioCap, and there's really work that has been done largely by the National Roundtable on Energy, on Environment and Economy. And they've looked at how do we fill this gap between now and 2050. And I've taken the results and summarized them in a slightly different way, and their overall conclusion is that there can be a domestic solution to filling this gap. It's going to require transformational change, and there's no one silver bullet. What we need here is silver buckshot. What we need is lots of very special solutions in order to address this problem. And part of it is efficiency and conservation, a very large part of it, is to reduce. We showed you the graph before. The per capita emissions of North Americans are more than twice that of Europeans, given the state of our gross domestic product. We need to reduce our emissions significantly. And that's partly industry and partly non-industry, the way we live, the way we move, and the way we make things and process our products. There's also a role for geological sequestration, carbon capture and storage, as you might have heard about it in the past in the newspapers. We got to look at nuclear, we look at cogeneration from and wind energy, solar, geothermal. And what I've done in this graph is pulled out, because my first love, I think, has been on the bioenergy. So I've taken all of the bioenergy components and said, what contribution could our agricultural and forest system, forestry industries and our sectors, our huge, vast biological resource in this country, make to the climate change solutions? We call those bioeconomy solutions. And so for the rest of the presentation today, I'm going to be focusing a little bit more on the bioeconomy solutions, and at the end I'll come back out to the larger issue of our energy systems. In the bioeconomy solutions, the one that I really want to focus on is there's opportunities to reduce emissions. Both 8 to 10% of our emissions come from methane and from cow burps, and their biological emissions directly from cows. So there are issues there in terms of emissions reductions and the way we manage agriculture. There's carbon sinks possible in agriculture and forestry. And then there's a major role for bioenergy and biofuels, and that's the one I want to focus on today. All right, when you think about biofuels today, we tend to think about corn-based or grain-based ethanol and grain-based biodiesel. And there have been a lot of concerns about these particular fuels in the newspapers and in the press. Concern about the competition for food crops. The concern that Canada is not the greatest place in the world to grow these things. There's a limited land area, and we need that for food production. What's the potential for grain-based crops to contribute to our fuel production, and even should we be doing so? What are the environmental costs associated with biodiversity, et cetera? And what are the benefits? When you actually look at the overall benefits to climate, or indeed to energy security, they're relatively small. So I think we need to start by stepping back and asking, if we're talking about using agriculture and forestry to help, to as a biofuel, why do we want biofuels in the first place? What's the reason? Well, three reasons have been identified for reasons for having biofuels: the rural economy, climate change, and energy security. It's very clear when I've asking questions both in different provincial governments and to the federal governments that the policies all the way up till March of this year have been all about the first one, about the rural economy. And in fact, I've got documents when I've hassled the government enough, formal documents of the government saying, nope, it's not about energy security, absolutely not. And if it happens to do something for climate change, great, but it's really about the rural economy. And I think maybe that explains why we have a biofuel policy the way we have in the country, is that I would argue that it's not focused on the right priorities. I would argue that if we have a biofuel policy, it should be really directed at energy security and climate change. And indeed, if you think about it, if our agriculture and forestry sectors actually contributed to energy security and climate change, the benefits to the rural economy would be greater, a huge amount greater, than any policies that are focused just on the rural economic development. So certainly the energy security is the number one driver. Anybody who's followed the election in the United States the last 2 years or whatever it is knows that that the energy security issue is one which has been on the lips of every politician that has been running in the last couple of years. So let's look at our energy systems. This is our energy, total energy use in Canada. It's 12 exajoules. An exajoule is just a unit of measure of energy. And they're associated with our residential, commercial, our industrial, transportation, and then we put a lot of energy into materials and things like plastic bottles and stuff, and we have power generation losses associated with our energy conversion systems. This is where we get our energy from. 80% of it is is the fossil fuels, natural gas, petroleum, and coal. Biomass provides about 5% of our energy. Most of that's targeted in the forestry sector. We have a major hydro contribution. There's limited capacity for future growth there. And, of course, we have a nuclear, especially in Ontario. Energy security issues are about the top two, about natural gas and oil, but particularly the petroleum component. Our greenhouse gas emissions are associated, the largest emissions are associated per unit of energy, this is, with coal. Coal has the most emissions per unit of energy delivered. Of the three fossil fuels, natural gas is the least, down to about 56% of what coal is, whereas about 74 to 80, depending on whether you're oil sands or conventional oil, is where we 85 or so, is where we see petroleum. Biomass is down, 15 is probably on the high side, it's between 10 to 15. Hydro and nuclear much less. So if we could shift, and you know, there's opportunities you can imagine to reduce our environmental footprint by increasing some of these other opportunities. So let's look at the bio opportunity, and let's put it in perspective. And I would like to, here as we go at the top of this plot again, right at the top is the 12 exajoules. That's Canada's total primary energy demand. Now let's think about, maybe we should stop eating. We'll never eat again. We're going to take all of our grain crops and all of our food and use it converted to energy to drive our cars, because that's more important, of course. We should stop building homes. We're not going to have any newspapers. We're going to have all of our forest and agriculture and forestry production directed to production of energy. We would be able to achieve 22% of Canada's primary energy input. That is the magnitude of the challenge. And I think that tries, that puts it. We are a major forestry export country. We export food products. We could take all of our domestic production of food and agriculture and divert it to energy, and we only still provide 22%. We obviously, this is a major energy challenge that we have. Now, we and others have done looking at what is the potential if we don't take our food. We continue to eat. We continue to use our wood products, the forestry products, as we have in the past with plans for growth in those. And we say, what could we go back to our biological systems and what could they produce? And there's two estimates there. And essentially, we've got a huge capacity for production of biomass that could be used for energy without interfering with our food and existing production for food and fiber. And I think to put this in perspective, I mean, Canada probably has more in this capacity on a per capita basis than any country in the world. We are blessed with huge numbers of energy alternatives in addition to fossil fuels. So the issue is what I'm proposing here is maybe we should set a target to say 20% of our energy need by 2030 could come from biomass. About 50% of that could be waste streams like forest residues and mill residues and fire residues and disease residues from forestry. It could come from the residues that come off of our agricultural systems as well as manure and municipal solid waste. They can provide about 50%. And the other 50% of that target would have to come from biomass production, special production systems that would produce biomass targeting for energy. If we did that, that would be equivalent to about 2 exajoules a year, or it'd be equivalent to about 1 million barrels of oil a day. That's what oil sands production was about 3 years ago, 3 to 4 years ago. So this is by 2030. It would provide 20% of Canada's primary energy needs by 2030. 130 million tons would be required. Now, in thinking about how we use that, I'd like you to just step back and think, we take each of these energy sources and we convert them into stuff that we really want to use. And one of the things I'm trying to drive home with this diagram is that we want to increase, we're talking about increasing biomass from this much to this much of our overall energy mix by 2030, if the models, if we accept those targets. We can convert that bioenergy to industrial residence use with 50 to 90% efficiency. Converting it, however, to transportation is very inefficient, only 10 to 50% efficient. And this is one of the problems with the environmental footprint of making liquid fuels. We can make it fairly efficient in making plastics, but probably if you looked at this and said, you know what, one of the worst things we do with biomass is make it into a liquid fuel, like ethanol, because it's the conversion efficiency. You lose so much of the energy in that conversion efficiency. So I think one of the conclusions is if the climate change is a key driver for bioenergy, then agriculture and forestry should target solid biofuels and replace coal, to target coal replacement. And if you think about it, compared to grain ethanol replacing gasoline, which is what our biofuel policy is today primarily, is it would have 10% of the cost for a CO2 emission reduction and half the cost of the primary energy input into our overall system. We're talking here about wood pellets or straw pellets that would be used, that could be made from solid biomass. We could also take, if we wanted to address both climate change and energy security, so in other words, we're talking about liquid fuel production to drive cars, etc., from biomass, we can make that from straw and wood, because you can get a lot more production of straw and wood on a hectare of land than you can grains. There are multiple methods for making liquid fuels, and the ones that seem to come out the best are the BTL technologies, or biomass to liquid. And here's a Volvo study from European Volvo, and it's just an example of a number of studies that looked at a whole range of different biofuels and analyzed them by different criteria. And the ones that are converted, there's three examples there, over seven criteria, including climate change, land use efficiency, integration with fossil fuels. The biomass gasification and biomass to liquid fuels seem to come out ahead of the others. So what kind, I'll just end on this, what kind of transformational systems would Canada need if we really wanted to use 20% of our energy, in other words, 130 million tons of biomass going in to provide the energy needs for Canada by 2030?
Still about 5 minutes,
okay. I've got three examples here, and this is the kind of transformative thinking that I think we need to do if we're going to look and address the question of climate change and energy security in the future. And this is just on biomass. There could do this for all wind power and everything else. One possibility is to consider setting up a bioenergy corridor around our natural gas pipelines. This map here shows the natural gas pipelines of Canada. And what I've done is 100 kilometers either side of a pipeline and said, that's our bioenergy corridor. So in the concept here is we'd bring biomass, sustainably produce the biomass in forestry and agriculture that is not being used for food production, and bring that to the pipeline, gasify that biomass, convert it through a thermochemical process into a syngas, and then chemically convert that into methane, exactly the same as natural gas, and put it into the pipeline. Essentially, we would use our existing pipeline infrastructure for fossil fuels, and we integrate the biomass into our natural gas pipeline system. We could provide 100 million tons, would provide about 30% of the Canadian natural gas demand, increasing energy security. In fact, we may find that we can then use natural gas to actually drive cars in cities, which have much lower air pollution footprint than diesel fuel. And indeed, this is some of the strategies being developed in Europe to try to address those sorts of things. So we could do that. Another is to actually recognize that we're using a huge amount of natural gas now in oil sands. Maybe we'd be better. We're using a beautiful fuel like natural gas to boil water, to make steam, to get oil sands out. Maybe that would be a better role for biomass, and we save that natural gas and redivert it back into our transportation sector or some other sectors of our energy economy. So this we'd be looking at developing pipelines or train lines to bring the biomass from across Western Canada in a more efficient way. It's a big challenge. And when you talk about the transportation of biomass as an energy, there's a huge opportunity in Eastern Canada. Not much of an opportunity for this in Alberta, but the reality is the cost per ton kilometer to move the material is cheapest on a ship. So build an energy corridor around the Great Lakes, St. Lawrence. And certainly there's a lot of interest in the province of Ontario now. When I was in Queens, we talked a lot about this. There's major programs going on to look at moving biomass through the Great Lakes St. Lawrence to provide not only coal plants and coal replacement, but refineries, petrochemical refineries, to supplement our petrochemical refinery energy inputs. Now, this is a group that's on public affairs, so I thought I would end my talk with some conclusions around recommendations for decision makers. And I don't know how many decision makers here in terms of political decision makers or industry decision makers are here, but certainly I think these are the kinds of recommendations. One is we need a North American energy strategy. Alberta is not an island. It's within Canada and it's within North America, and we've got to have an energy strategy that recognizes both energy security and climate change and what's the optimal role we can play within it. We have to rethink our energy system, including the optimal uses for energy resources, not just oil sands, but all of our energy resources. We need to put a price on carbon. It's absolutely critical. We're not going to make the changes unless there is a negative signal or a signal that says if you emit carbon, you have to pay more. That will create the signal to reduce it. We also, I would argue, need to put a price on energy security. And maybe that involves taxes that might tax imports and stimulate domestic energy production. We need to be thinking about these things if we're really going to meet the challenges of energy security and climate change. We need to recognize that we need silver buckshot. There is no silver bullet. Don't expect cold fusion to solve it. Somebody's not going to survive. We need energy efficiency and conservation. We need alternative renewable energies. We need lower emission hydrocarbons. And we need to do carbon capture and storage. It's not an or, it's an and. And then when we get into biofuels, and I've got three left, clarify policy objectives for biofuels. What are we doing it for? And make sure that our policies align with those objectives. We got to consider a solid biofuel standard, I would argue. If our objective is climate change and energy security, we need to provide a solid. We're talking about, we have a 5% bioethanol standard in gasoline. Why not have a 5% or 10% solid biofuel standard in all coal users? What that would do is a 10% of coal use in Alberta alone, this is just Alberta, would create a market for 3 to 4 million tons of biomass. And those of you who have been in the agriculture business, think about 3 to 4 million tons of straw or wood. And it would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 5 to 6 million tons of CO2 per year, and it would do it at a lower cost than what's now available or could be done with carbon capture and storage. We need to support, and this is my advertisement, we need to support university research. And I got to end with an ad. The IC is an example of but one university research institute. One of the advantages of university research is we don't have a stake or an interest in a particular solution. We need to be looking objectively at all the solutions and come up with, and through critical analysis and great arguments and discussions and training really intelligent students, we need to find, develop the solutions that are going to take us forward to more sustainable energy system. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. That was right up to your usual standard of an information-filled presentation, and I'm sure it will generate a lot of questions. I found that picture of the polar bear particularly compelling. I haven't seen that one before, and I actually wonder if there's a smell of a bit of Photoshop around that guy. The only more imaginative pictures I've seen of animals on ice floes were penguins in the Arctic. Thanks again, and we'll have questions in about 1 o'clock.